It's Saturday, November 17th, 2012. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the Central Coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio. Today on Geek Speak, it's geek news and your calls and questions about technology. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Miles Elam. In the radio station with me is Ben Jaffe, web instructor and world traveler. Hello, Ben.
What's up? Hey, I actually kind of like that theme music. We should have just gone with that, you know.
Have some more Miles Davis.
You know, if you listen to NPR, you hear that so often, that song. And for some reason, I don't know about other people, but for me, that doesn't actually get old. It's one of those very few songs that never gets old for me. So it's pretty cool.
We are going to have another guest in very soon, but for now, I'm going to wait till for introducing her when she arrives. Ben, would you like to start your first story?
I would love to. So I just want to talk briefly about Android. Android is that, so you have an iPhone, you're running what's called iOS. That's the operating system. Okay. But if you have an Android phone, or, I mean, a lot of people actually are running Android and they don't know it. It turns out that Android now owns 73%, almost three quarters of the worldwide smartphone market, which is ridiculous. Now, if you're in the United States, you kind of have this dichotomy. Do you want to get an iPhone? Do you want to get an Android? You know, and in my life, at least, I know more people who have gotten iPhones than Androids. So this was surprising to read. But it turns out that in China, we have over 90% of smartphones running Android. So that explains a lot of it.
Which would make a lot more sense.
Yeah, definitely.
Because one of the points about Android phones is that they're open hardware, right? You can put anyone that has access to a system that can run Linux and that Android operating system can make a phone.
Exactly. And so within the United States, I don't actually have the numbers, but worldwide, 73%. Those are pretty stunning numbers. And the same time last year, we were at 52.5%. So they pretty much took over the third quarter of the smartphone market within 1 year.
That's all
worldwide.
Very interesting to me because from a developer standpoint, Android is painful. And I don't mean that in terms of difficulty level. It's it's a Java-like syntax.
Are you talking about the fragmentation?
Yeah, the fact that you have so many different devices. One of the things about it is it's similar to back in the day, the Mac versus PC compatible computers where you had, on the Mac side, very homogeneous hardware setups.
Yeah, there are like three devices, and they all ran OS X, and nothing else ran OS X.
Oh, I'm talking about way back in the day. I'm talking like the Mac SEs and the like, so
whatever.
That you had, or the Mac, you know, the Mac 2, the LC, that type of thing.
But it's even still now true. It's only Apple hardware products that run OS X with very, very few exceptions like Intel Hackintoshes and things like
that. Whereas on the PC side or nowadays with the Android side, you have devices that have 256 megs of RAM, 512 megs of RAM, some with a gig of RAM, some with 128 megs of RAM.
Big
some of
screens,
them with
small
screens, 3-inch screens, 4-inch screens, 4.1-inch screens.
What?
3.6
screen, two screen, red screen, blue screen. You know. So actually, I've got news on that too. So Google has recently, just a couple days ago, updated its software development kit legal agreement. And basically, they added this new paragraph, amongst other things. They added this new paragraph, which says, you agree that you will not take any actions that may cause or result in the fragmentation of Android, including, but not limited to, distributing, participating in the creation, never promoting in any way, software development kit derived from the SDK. So this is yet another step they're trying to take to deal with this fragmentation problem. We'll see how successful this one was.
That may be the case with regard to Android and trying to normalize things, but will that also push the carriers to update Android? That's
now
actually
that,
been the biggest issue, is that you have Android devices that are 2.2, version 2.3.
And 2.0 is a long time ago in smartphone terms.
Yeah, and they're still around because those devices, their updates, unlike iOS, which is independent of the carrier, that you can update your iPhone OS to, you know, from 4 to 4.1 1 to 4.2 to 5 to 5.1 to 6. Mm-hmm. And you do that as a consumer, and it doesn't matter if you're on AT&T or Verizon or Sprint, you can always just update it. With Android phones, by and large, it's the carrier that decides when and if you can update.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
In addition to the hardware limitations.
So yeah, when I read this, I thought, well, isn't it it's the inaction more than anything that leads to the fragmentation. The people not updating, or the carriers rather not updating, rather than an active action to create fragmentation.
On the contrary, there are some carriers that are releasing phones that already are incompatible with the most recent version. In other words, they don't have the mm-hmm. hardware specs to handle it. They are releasing phones that are old. Yeah, that have just 3.0, for example.
Yeah, that's interesting. But I mean, one of the reasons I would argue that Android is so popular worldwide is that it's incredibly cheap compared to an iPhone. I mean, you have a lot of devices out there which may not actually run the latest version of Android, but they're very cheap to manufacture. And so as a result, the cost is a lot lower, and then a lot more people go with an Android device. So maybe in a way it's the fragmentation that lends itself to Android's success.
Well,
in addition to
the choice of a handset to have, the choice of feature set to have, how expensive you want the phone to be, mm-hmm. is absolutely a driver for consumers. Mm-hmm. For developers, for example, we were talking about the version issue with Android and having to develop for version 2.2, version 2.3, for version 4, know, and all points in between. And with iOS, the most recent version has a more than 2/3 rate. So of all the people who have iPhones, two-thirds of them have the most recent version of the operating system, and it's only been out for a couple of months now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm building an app using PhoneGap for Android and iOS, and in terms of what I test on, I find myself getting very lazy when it comes to iOS testing. I'm only really interested in testing on the latest version and the one prior. Because two major versions prior, I don't know. Smartphone users
are kind of
like...
There are people who are running iOS 4 or 4.2 or the like, but they're on the order of like 2% of the iPhone mm-hmm. market. It's ridiculous how small that percentage ends up being.
So how much development time do you want to put to that? That's the real question.
That's where you come into graceful degradation.
Yes.
And that's unfortunately where it lies with the Android market, is that a good portion of the entire platform is about graceful degradation, mm-hmm. as opposed
graceful
to
graceful degradation being,
in other words, that you have a feature that you're coding for the web, or for a device that says, I want to do, actually all phones do geolocation, so that's not a good example. But
well, let's say gradients, for example. And I mean, nowadays most browsers do gradients, but it's a good example because you can say, I want this application to have a nice pretty gradient that looks like the sky or something like that. But mm-hmm. then if the device doesn't support gradients, I'm just going to make the background blue because every device can make a solid shade.
Yeah.
Yeah. So graceful degradation being degrading the experience back to something that's still usable as opposed to breaking the app.
Right. And that's just for visuals. There's also items that go on the back end that mm-hmm. You can't use on Android because those features haven't come about. It's not because they don't exist. It's just because the phones haven't been updated.
Yeah, the old phones that we're talking about haven't been updated.
And some of the new ones that are being released as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, smartphone years, though, are kind of like dog years. It's interesting. Like, you think about just going back a couple of years.
If you ever hear web developers complain about Internet Explorer, for example, uh-huh. and we have on this show before, when you talk about things like, oh, I hate Internet Explorer 7 or I hate Internet Explorer 6, and I wish that people would get off of it and get onto Firefox or Chrome or Opera or mm-hmm. any of these others. We talk about also the need for graceful degradation because there are still a lot of people that are running them. And
especially people in large companies where their IT infrastructure just hasn't they haven't gotten the money to move them to a different browser, to a better browser.
Right.
And, or they're even stuck on the browser for certain reasons.
Yeah, in the mobile space, that used to be BlackBerries, but most people are giving up their BlackBerries for Android or iOS devices or Windows phones. And so that has bumped up, but now your limiting factor is turning toward those older revisions of Android.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic. Oh, I've just got one quick announcement. For those of you guys who use CyanogenMod, and I'll explain what that is in a moment. I'll explain what it is now. CyanogenMod, because Android is open source, these people created a project called CyanogenMod, and it's a modification of Android which runs with all of these additional features that these people want on their phones, but the Android platform didn't give them to begin with or right out of the box. And so a lot of people have rooted their phones and are actually running these new modified Rooting their phone being getting...
Taking away the control from the carrier and bring it into your own hands.
Yes, or at least giving control to yourself, the same control that the carrier has to yourself. So
can the carrier re-update on top of...
Oh, yeah, I guess not. Yeah, yeah, so it is taking away the control. So you install basically this modified version of Android. My quick announcement is that if anyone of you guys are using CyanogenMod, and I've used it quite a bit, it's a really great operating system based on Android, now they're using CyanogenMod.org instead of CyanogenMod.com. There was this whole kerfuffle with one of their members who had access to CyanogenMod.com, who kind of held it ransom for $10,000, and all. There's this whole story, and it's really a bummer to see this happen to an open source project, or to a project like this. You know, they don't make money doing this. They just do it because they love it for the most part. Mm-hmm. You know, and the money that they do make is used to offset their server costs and their build machine costs and those kinds of things. So
this is actually very similar to that old adage of, if you're worried about hacking or someone compromising your systems, most hacks are actually from inside the company. Mm-hmm. Not from an outside malicious hacker cracking your firewall.
And they're in the what we call the meat space, which is the space of human beings, not the space of bits and bytes and computers, right?
Social engineering, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of exploits are just social engineering, convincing people to give you their password or to plug in a USB drive inside of a protected network or something like that, right?
Or a disgruntled employee.
In this case, yeah. A disgruntled volunteer. I assume volunteer. If you're using CyanogenMod, you're going to be using CyanogenMod.org now, because .com goes to nowhere because he deleted the DNS entries for it.
Well, he should have some good luck with that. Now he has a domain that no one goes to.
Exactly. I don't know. Well,
that's a shame.
It's really a shame. Yeah. Anyway, do you have a news story?
I do. There's a rogue planet out there.
A rogue planet?
Yeah, actually, there are many rogue planets out there. But and before we get any really odd comments coming in, I'm not talking about some rogue planet that's going to cross our path.
Oh, yeah, we're not talking about Planet X.
Going in and taking us out, and that being the reason for the Mayan calendar ending
this year. The alien homeworld.
No. This planet rather is quite a ways away, or at least from our perspective, we're not going to see it, or we're not going to be able to travel to it in our lifetimes.
Yeah,
I believe it's 140 light years away.
Oh, that's pretty far.
Well, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it's not very far, but
in our scheme of things, it is, because
yes,
furthest man-made object, the Voyager 1 probe, I think it's something like 13 light hours away. Light hours, not light years, not light days, light hours. So that's a tiny fraction of, that's like 1/500 of one light year, and we're talking about 140 light years. So it is pretty far away.
Right. And when I talk about a rogue planet, I don't mean, a planet wearing leather and carrying a couple of daggers in their back belt.
So it doesn't have a star, then?
It does not have a star. It's a Yeah, it's a planet that does not orbit a star. And
I guess that's the only thing, one of the only things I can imagine that would make a planet rogue, right? I mean, what do you expect of planets?
Well, you could have something happen to the star or something happen in an irregular orbit mm-hmm. that would throw the planet out from an existing orbit.
Yeah.
But if you're talking about planets in general, what they're looking at with this rogue planet is that it formed very much like a star typically does. The only thing is it did not have enough mass to ignite the sustained fusion of hydrogen.
Really?
It does have some deuterium, heavy hydrogen, mm-hmm. and that is being fused. So there is some warmth. There is some ignition going on sporadically, but it doesn't have a sustained fusion reaction like a star does. And once, if a star or if a planet grows to, let's see, 13 times the mass of Jupiter, then it will ignite, and you'll have at that level a brown dwarf. In other words,
which is a type of star,
a very cool burning star.
Yeah. Very teeny star, relatively
speaking.
Well,
cool burning, yeah.
Yeah, cool burning.
And this planet is trying to see how big it is, but it is, it's 13 times the mass of Jupiter. You have to be slightly larger than that to be a brown dwarf.
Mm-hmm. Wow, so we've got a rogue planet that we think formed like a star, but didn't become a star. So it's a planet star or something?
It's a planet. It's a super Jupiter.
Super Jupiter.
Yeah.
That sounds like an ABBA song or something.
Yeah, anything that doesn't make it to a sustained fusion reaction that is still of a size greater than a planet. In other words, it has formed in such a way as to become its gravity has caused it to become spherical.
That is pretty cool. Hey, I've actually got some news about planets too.
Go for it.
And so it's actually about the Kepler Observatory. I've talked about the Kepler ad nauseum for several years. And actually, you know what's really cool? The Kepler Observatory has come to the end of its prime mission. Its main mission, it was a 3.5-year mission. And its goal...
Kind of like Star Trek. Although it was a 5-year message, but they only lasted 3.
Yeah, I really wanted to say a 2-hour tour, but you know that's what happens with these NASA projects is they complete their mission and then they keep going on to do amazing things. Look at our Mars rovers, for example. You know, they stuck around for a lot longer. We've been using this Kepler data. We've done a whole lot with this and with this observatory. I'm just going to read off a couple of the things that we've done. And one other thing that this made me realize, I've been doing the show for much more than 3.5 years because that's when this started. And I, that's when the show started. Okay, I got distracted because we now have another guest, which maybe we should introduce her now.
Finish your story first, and then I'll do the introduction.
Oh, dear. Okay, well, let me just run down the quick bullet list of what we've done with Kepler. In August 2010, they confirmed the discovery of the first planetary system with more than one planet transiting the same star. In January of 2011, not much long after, they announced the discovery of the first rocky planet. Unquestionably rocky planet outside of the system, which is Kepler-10b. Just the month after that, they announced that they found a very crowded and compact planetary system with multiple planets. In September of that year, they found a world with a double sunset, kind of like in Star Wars. Is that Tatooine that has a mm-hmm. double sunset? Yes, awesome. Disney bought LucasArts. That should be interesting. Anyway,
I don't think we're going to discuss that this time. not until tempers have cooled.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it could either be really good or really bad. December of 2011, they found the first planet within the habitable zone. The habitable zone is the zone in which water could exist upon the planet's surface, and that was 2.5 about times the size of the Earth. February of this year, they announced another 1,000 transiting planet candidates that need to be confirmed, of course. But now they have 2,321 as of February. They have a lot of planets that they've found, and they've successfully completed their mission. But it's not over. So now they're going on another mission, just continuing orbiting around Earth. But this is going to be a 4-year mission. And the idea is they're going to try to find more planets like Earth. So they're going to focus more on that, because we haven't quite found a planet that's enough like Earth to make us happy. So that's what the next 4 years is about. Okay. Pretty cool stuff.
And speaking of celestial bodies, we now have the inimitable Bonnie Jean Primsch, mediator, printmaker, and broadcaster at large. Thank you so much for joining
us. What's up, guys? Hey, Ben. Hey, Miles.
High five.
Okay, I'm still on this rogue planet, because it kind of sounds like it's just like a little star that couldn't.
That's exactly what it is.
It's a star fetus.
I think I can.
If it got more mass, if it created more mass, it could ignite into a brown dwarf.
It just needs more little star hormones or something.
Unfortunately, it's all alone. It's just floating out there in no man's land. So if another 13 of them came together, then they would have enough. They would clump together, and the gravity would be intense enough that it would ignite fusion in its core.
Teamwork.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I love anthropomorphizing things like this. It just gives me this nice glow, this warm,
as it is,
fuzzy
it's just
feel.
A,
yeah, no pun intended.
Sad little rock out there.
Nice glow. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Nice glow. Yeah. Okay. Carry on. Hi, everyone.
Hey, yeah.
We are now coming to the midpoint in our show. And I want to let you know that you are listening to 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org, and you can follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook. This is GeekSpeak. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by the Cultural Council of Santa Cruz County. The Cultural Council helps local arts thrive by providing funding, advocacy, and support to artists and arts organizations. Further information is available at ccscc.org or 475-9600. And Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support for businesses and tech support for home computers. Home and Small Business Tech specializes in protecting data and has been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. We are taking phone calls.
I got a geek bit, too.
And we have a geek bit. We have the wonderful and generous with his time, Rick Philman, answering our calls, answering phones. The number here is 476-2800 or toll-free 1-800-655-5877. And we will try to answer any questions that you have. We may not answer them correctly, but we will try to answer them.
We'll answer them somehow.
Ben, your geek bit.
Yeah, do you also have a geek bit? Can I give two geek bits?
Sure.
Google has rolled out a web experiment. Basically, it's just a website. And it's for Chrome. I think it works in Firefox too. All right. And it gives you a visualization of the locations of 100,000 nearby stars in your browser. And you can click, drag around, zoom in, zoom out, go through a little tour. And it also does a pretty good idea. It does a pretty good job of demonstrating the amount of space that we're talking about. Like, it's ridiculous.
I heard about this, that it was astronomically accurate.
Yes, it's
So that's a lot of scrolling through to find the
three-dimensional positioning and all of that.
Well, I believe the scrolling is done in orders of magnitude. So
yeah. Well, I would hope.
Oh God, if it wasn't.
I do have other things to do with my time.
I've been scrolling for years and still.
But it also uses a technology known as WebGL, which, tying into our earlier conversation, is a technology that is showing up in newer browsers. But we're waiting for older browsers to die off so that we can actually get this into the mainstream. So it's really nice to see projects like this coming from Google that are prompting people to say, oh, if you want to see this, you need to download this newer browser.
Yes, absolutely.
They do keep doing that, don't they?
They do keep doing that. It makes me happy.
Well, Firefox and Chrome have made it easier now. It's an automatic download. You don't have to think about it. It just says, hey, there's a new version. Click this button to restart your browser.
Yeah. Bam, done. If only we could make it that easy for IE 6 and 7 and 8, then everyone would be so happy. Development times would be cut in half.
Or 9 and 10 for that matter.
Well, sure, 9 and 10 for that matter. But I mean, speaking of orders of magnitude of issues, Okay, I've got one more geek bit, and this is this awesome app I just found. It's free. It's called Songza, S-O-N-G-Z-A. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. And so I just opened it up right now, and it's a music app. And it pops up, and it says, it's Saturday late morning. Do you want to play music for a relaxing weekend, reading the paper, falling back asleep, waking up?
This. It's the soundtrack to
driving
life,
a cool
guys.
Car. It yeah. is so great, working out. It's so great. So you click on one of these things. I just clicked on a relaxing weekend, and it pops up with six categories. You can choose which one you want. So if you want to listen to retro lounge or pop and jazz standards or new age, you choose one of those. And then it gives you three playlists, and you can choose of those three playlists, whatever you want to listen to. And I've been using this.
What about if you want to drift off to sleep to hardcore industrial techno?
Well,
you can game the system by choosing a different time of day, I'm
that,
sure.
That is true. You can also look for playlists individually by genre and all that stuff. But I've been using this particular feature all the time. Pretty much every morning I wake up and it knows that I want to listen to super happy, inspirational, you know, wake up and go do something good in the world
before
music.
Before you go, go.
Before you go, go.
Wait, so do they hit it on the nose musically?
They do a pretty darn good job. They are curated playlists. It's a Pandora kind of experience, kind of mixed with Spotify.
Well, okay, so curated by Spotify types?
Curated by some of their staff. And I think also, I'm not sure if users can actually curate podcasts or playlists.
I'm sure that's next though, right, Ben?
It must be. I think they've kind of hit it on the nose. They're a pretty popular app. I actually found about them through the trending apps on the Android App Store. So, also, I'm going to be putting a link up to a webcam with five baby kittens that I've been running on my second monitor constantly as I've been coding, and it's been keeping me very happy. So that's not too geeky. I don't know. Kittens are kind of a meme, I guess, at this point. So
I was actually thinking how there are many people who have dual monitor setups, but it's still kind of a geeky thing to do. So on my second monitor, I have the... and on my third monitor, I have puppies.
Actually, I'm looking at them right now. They're all asleep.
I see snoozing cats.
They're so cute. Anyway,
everyone
I'm allergic
kittens.
To cats, so this is the best I can do.
Virtual pets.
Bonnie, did you have any...
I've got a burning question, you guys, about this whole Petraeus email tracking, how they're finding things out is fast. Is it, in fact, kind of signaling for everyone the end of privacy that this show has been creeping me out about for years now?
Well, let's start off with the fact that Petraeus was the head of the CIA.
Right.
That this is a government email network.
Mm-hmm.
And...
Well, it's
there
a government
was,
email network, but there's something about a Gmail account, and they did that thing where they write each other.
But it was actually on the official network that's where they found the incriminating emails. That's where that came from.
Yeah.
So
you were talking about this. This was like 5 or 6 months ago, it was back in April. The 1986 Electronic Communications Privacy Act that says that email that's been on a server for over 6 months can be considered abandoned and therefore is subject to search. Yeah, and you were...
There was actually some news that was before that is much shorter than that, meaning if you download it from the mail server, it's no longer in your possession.
That's... Yes.
And
so,
yeah.
In addition to that, there's that other story as well, but...
So those are the things that we're feeding into the rapid-fire accumulation of information sortedness that we've seen over the last week.
Yes. Right. I have mixed feelings about this. On the one hand, I wish that we as a nation were as upset with... war and poverty as we were about sex scandals.
Well, I mean, it does strike me that if the guy resigns with, sorry, I had an extramarital affair, instead of, sorry, I want to spend time with my family, that the cover-up is something major.
Yeah, well, but there's also that aspect of if you're the head of an organization that is all about keeping secrets mm-hmm. And you know, that type of thing, then...
Blackmail,
maybe you should
right?
keep. Maybe you should keep that secret a little bit better.
Oh,
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it does kind of lower the. I mean, just like the expectation that we should be able to track all of our stuff and keep everything private. You know, if Petraeus can't do it, well, all right, then the expectation's a lot lower on me to be able to pull it off.
Yeah.
But also,
well, that's interesting. Although I think that I think that there is a good. I think it's easy to confuse. The man being able to keep things secret versus the agency that he's a part of supposed to be able to keep things secret, right?
Yeah.
Now, who knows what the actual situation was.
I believe the issue wasn't so much the emails that he sent. It was the emails that were sent to him or to third parties. Actually, I think it was to the third party that was really the issue. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the problems with security, is that it's not just your own feelings of security. And that's also been my issues with things like Facebook, is that it's not just your own ability to keep yourself private and to make that dividing line, but also all the people that you are connected to.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Blob, Miles Elam has checked you into the cafe that you're both at. I mean, now my location is basically public, right? Yeah. But I didn't choose to share it. It's just because I chose to be friends with you, Miles.
Yeah. Or those issues where people pressures. Get fired because of, you know, some drunken debauch that shows up on a web page. That's because someone tagged you,
right?
Not because you decided to put them there. You may not have even known that the picture was taken.
But that's not quite what's going on with this, you know, what they're uncovering over emails. And
it was my understanding that the adulteress had emailed the family friend, and the family friend complained to a third party that there was harassment, and then during the investigation found more information. Yeah,
there, I mean, there's whole confusing flowcharts.
Yeah, I had a flowchart about this, but
who's connected to what?
I've been ignoring this story. I don't know. Scandals,
but it's been effortless, right? Uncovering this stuff has just been effortless over the last week.
Relatively, yeah.
Because it's all find outable now.
You have a digital trace to go back.
So I guess everyone be forewarned.
The only way to get around that was the story that we were hearing from the previous administration about White House emails. Oh, sorry, our email server is busted. We can't get those emails back again. I guess the only way really around it is to try to find some way of plausible deniability.
Right. Yeah.
Or just not maintaining your stuff.
But any tips for people trying to keep things private out there that can work around the sort of easy discovery that...
I mean, if you're the head of the CIA or some other similarly high-profile position, hire a security expert. That's what you should do. But if you're just, you know, Joe Schmo, like any of us, just don't be the lowest hanging fruit. I think that's the simplest. It's not 100%. It's not 80%. But it's a way of basically, like, don't have a simple, super, super simple password. Don't have the same exact password for all of your sites, especially your bank and your email, because your email gets password resets, you know, little things like that you can do, which.
Definitely do not have your finances on the same password as your social network.
Right. Yeah. And these little things make it only marginally more difficult to hack into your account. But, and I mean, some of them a lot more difficult, but some of them only marginally more difficult. A lot of these attacks on people, a lot of these identity theft things are automated, you know? Right. They do 100,000 of them at a time, and they figure out who is the easiest to get access to all of their data and everything, right? And they do that, and then if you're not the lowest hanging fruit, they're probably going to be able to hack you, but they'll choose not to because of time.
They'll go for the easy marks first.
Yeah, what's most economical as a hacker. So that's number one.
So and that's then, assuming you're in just like a mass ball of hackery. But what if for some reason someone's singling you out?
That's a good question.
If you're a business and some organization is trying to target you, that is a much, much harder problem to solve. You probably will get hacked. Just a question of how quickly you can respond to it and figure out that there's been a breach and try to shore up those resources. And unfortunately, far too many large companies have discovered this. There is the cynic in me that kind of agrees with, or at least from a pragmatic standpoint, agrees with Bob Metcalf and Scott McNeely, some pioneers of the tech industry and networking world, that we don't have privacy anymore. And to quote Scott McNeely, we don't have privacy, get over it. And
that was a response that I heard in response to this whole Petraeus thing is, guys, see, privacy's over. It's over.
Yeah, I don't want to believe that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I didn't want a Facebook account, but so many people tagged me in things that there was a virtual Miles Elam you know, as a page up there already on Facebook that people could go to and get this aggregation of information. So it's the only reason I joined Facebook was so that at least I could manage that narrative.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So it's not so much about our privacy as managing our public face.
Yeah. But at the same time, if a whole bunch of people get onto another social network that I don't know about, how do I control that? It's a tough thing, and this is an area where I think it's a social problem, to a technical problem that cannot easily be solved. I think it's more along the social problem, and this is one of the areas that I would actually think that legislation would be useful. Something similar to what the EU has with regard to actually codifying privacy into the Code of Human Rights.
That's happening?
That has already happened. They have much more strict privacy laws than we do. It has been historically the basis for a long time.
Right. Hmm. So what's the... Well, I mean, here's a rabbit hole we could go down, right? There's the whole conversation about what politically needs to happen in this country in order for those kind of privacy regulations to be palatable over here. But my
let's go a little bit lighter and take some calls.
Yeah. Sorry.
No.
Doom and gloom, you guys. How's it going?
Let's just dodge that.
Let's try taking a call from Peggy in Santa Cruz. Peggy, hello.
Hi there. So I have a question for you guys. I have a Windows 7 laptop. I've had it for about 6 months, and every morning when I either turn it on or make it wake up, the Windows welcome screen doesn't open right. It'll be just kind of this green with the little blue up on top as it finally scrolls down. And it takes like maybe 2 or 3 minutes for it to actually load correctly.
Okay, so this is, you haven't shut down the laptop. This is just closing the lid and then opening it back up again. It takes a while?
It doesn't matter if I just do that or if I've shut it off completely. It still does it.
Okay. Now, it should take longer than just closing the lid, but it sounds like, yeah, you may be having some issue there with sleep restore or suspend restore.
But it does it like where it's green and then there's like a bar of blue that finally just kind of like slowly comes down the screen.
And I
sent it off to HP. They couldn't duplicate it. They had a technician come out and they couldn't duplicate it. So I'm wondering, what do I do now?
And does this happen consistently for you? Is it just for you?
Every day. Yeah.
Every day for you. But then what was different about the situation when they were trying to replicate it when they came out?
It just opened up and loaded correctly.
It just worked. Yeah, that's...
This is always the case. Like when you go to the mechanic, the wheel stops making that noise.
Exactly. And I'm a home business, so... My whole business is on this computer, and so I'm really scared that one day Windows just won't work.
Okay, so number one, do you have backups?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, so that means that you're not going to have that issue where you're going to have everything go away.
You'll have a day or two of inconvenience.
Yeah,
but
it'll be a heavy inconvenience. That's unfortunate. But I just want to be sure that you're not going to be left going, oh wait, I've lost all of my invoices for the last 6 months.
Too bad about your business.
Yeah. Here's another question for you.
No.
Is this problem getting worse or is it about the same every day?
It's about the same every day.
Okay. It might just be something with your Windows installation that. I don't know. Miles
okay,
has this
when,
look on his face.
the thing is, it's really odd to me that it is so consistent for you, but didn't happen when you went to HP. So I'm really curious to try to isolate what was different in those two environments. So
could it be a time of day thing or a temperature thing?
I can see a temperature thing, except that you were when you open it up first thing in the morning, it does this, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so...
And then it doesn't do it at all for the rest of the day. So it seems to be, it's off for like 8 hours.
So it only happens if it's been off for a long period of time.
When you took it to HP to have it serviced, had you used it before that day?
Yes, but I think it probably took like 2 days to get to their place, but...
Okay, you mailed it off to them. Okay.
Yeah, but then they had the technician actually come out to my house, and I didn't wake it up or turn it on at 8 as my normal time. I waited till he got there, and it was like noon.
That's really interesting.
Completely confused.
So, I mean, we're kind of only working off of a consistent problem plus two data points to the contrary, right?
Yeah.
And from what I can tell, my best guess would be a temperature thing. I don't know about you guys.
I'm leaning in that direction, but...
Try putting it in the oven for... don't do that.
No.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
No.
Well, I mean, another thing that you could probably safely do is put it in the refrigerator for a while. You know, like you I mean...
Okay, that's... Not, don't do that.
Don't do that.
There are ways that you could put... there are times when you would put things into a refrigerator or a freezer, but you
not,
also...
Not
it,
a, ooh, freezer,
you also
though.
No, actually, you do that for hard drives. I've had that successfully for
getting
it working
again. Yeah, you just don't want it
again.
To get cold enough that water can start...
No, what freezing. You do is you double bag it. You make sure that the condensation ooh. Does not show up right on the drive that it... anyway, but that's a whole other... that's a whole other conversation. And we just want to verify, everything works okay once it gets working?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm leaning towards Ben's hypothesis then that it's a heat issue that...
And why would that be the case?
And you're in Santa Cruz, so it's been fairly cold in the mornings?
Yeah, but this has been going on for a few months.
Okay, so something I am curious about, though, is just to get another data point,
sure.
is I would... be curious if you try not starting it up first thing in the morning and do it exactly the way that it worked for the HP technician that came in. In other words, wait until noon or 1.
And
that means you're losing half a day, though.
It does.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe on a weekend?
Well, I could do that, sure, on a weekend.
And this is just to get another data point, just to find out, is this time sensitive or is this temperature sensitive? At least okay. you could know like some variable that can make it toggle.
Yeah. And one other thing you could try as far as the temperature thing without using a refrigerator is, you could, if you shut it down, maybe at 10 PM, and then if you happen to be up at midnight, try and wake it up. You know, because 2 hours of it cooling off, it'll be the middle of the night. It'll be whatever temperature it is in the morning, roughly, probably.
No, I mean, it'll be coolest just before dawn. But I mean, that's...
Well, that's true. But I mean, you might be able to reproduce the issue without going to sleep and waking up and then having the issue. You might actually be able to reproduce the issue without
this,
that.
This laptop problem is giving you sleepless nights, right? So one of these times when you're up, you know, getting a warm glass of milk in the morning, in the early morning... Give it a try. It's all about trying to falsify basically our hypothesis.
Yeah. So if it turns out to be a temperature issue, then what?
Then one, you can talk to HP again and talk about this is the scenario that's causing the problem, mm-hmm. And try to persuade them to replace the laptop if it's still under warranty. I'm assuming it is if you have a technician come out.
Couldn't you just get like a little laptop cozy or something? Keep it warm.
That's another option.
You could sleep.
That's another option is preheating it. Yeah. Doing the same thing that people in colder climes do for their cars. Like have a preheater that warms the engine before they actually try starting.
But of course, first try and isolate that variable and see if that actually is the issue. Because it could just be unfortunate chance. You know, it's.
And when we say warming it up, please don't put it onto a stove burner.
Okay.
A couple other things that you could think or that you could try to do are try suspend or sleep or standby or hibernate. I don't remember exactly what, I'm not sure what Windows version you're using, but try those various options if you have different options. Also try shutting it down and see if any of those things affect the problem at all. The other thing that's curious to me about this is usually electronics work better when they're colder rather than when they're hot. You know, we have heat sinks for this reason. And that's why you put, like, if a hard drive is just not reading data, you can try putting it in a refrigerator
or a freezer.
It does depend,
because, like, all computers, all circuit boards have solder joints.
Oh, that's a good point.
And when a lot of electronics, that's one of the reasons why they fail, is because the solder joints, the electronics are heating and cooling, and so you have these joints that are expanding and contracting,
ever
and
so
they
slightly,
can crack, yeah. And or they can separate. And so one thing that may be happening is that there's something that isn't causing it to crash, which is a little unusual, but at the same time, I have seen it happen. And as it heats up, you are making that connection. You're closing that circuit that wasn't closed before.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and this is all very, very theoretical. I mean,
yeah.
Right.
Know.
And like we said, we just we need more data points, and we'd love to find out what has happened. Please email us, email the geeks at geekspeak.org. Let us know how it goes.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Thanks for the call.
Problem.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
It is sort of homey having something just not be comfortable enough to start up properly.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I felt that way when I woke up this morning. Like, oh, God.
I'm not comfortable enough to get up.
And we still have some time for some calls. The phone lines are open. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877. In the air room with me are Ben Jaffe and Bonnie Jean Primsch. Ben, do you have another story for us?
I do. Actually, I'm gonna change my little order. I'm gonna talk about encrypting laptops because we've been talking about security.
Encrypting laptops.
And,
so,
yeah.
Okay.
So we've been talking about security. We've been talking about ways in which you can make yourself more secure. There, of course, are there are I guess a couple ways of doing it. Right. There is protecting yourself against attacks to your machine, digital attacks to your machine. So that really has to do with things that are coming into and going out of your machine over the network, right?
Which isn't as much about cryptography. That's more of having like network rules, firewalls,
yes.
and the like. Yeah.
Yes.
Antivirus.
So that's one way that you can protect yourself is working with that. Another way you can protect yourself is things like passwords to online services and whatnot, like Gmail or whatever your email client is. Another way that you can protect yourself is from your laptop getting stolen or from you losing your laptop. You know, probably at some point in everyone's life, they'll lose their phone or they'll lose their laptop, right? So what happens to your laptop after that, right? If the wrong person gets a hold of it, then they could sell the information on it. They could probably get financial information from that laptop, right? If you have
right.
a password,
if you have a phone that has an app, like Mint or the like, if
be careful
you
about that.
Absolutely,
really, really
have a passcode on your phone, or if the app has a passcode, use that.
Yeah, and it's kind of, you know, it's walking the fine line between convenience and security. So, I think it's always better to walk the line toward the more secure, right? But if you do lose your phone or you do lose your laptop, and you have a password, you're still not necessarily 100% safe. So NASA has actually had this issue where they have lost a good number of laptops over the years. In fact, 48 mobile computing devices have been stolen over the last 2 years, basically. That's a lot of devices, and they've got a lot of sensitive information on those devices.
For the size of the organization, actually, that sounds reasonable because that's what happens with large organizations. Different technology gets legs, like, you know, projectors from a conference room suddenly disappear. Yeah.
Yeah. And they, for some reason, want to leave. I don't know.
Some AV guys.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, yeah, 48 is a low number for such a big organization as NASA, but still, that's 48. And
I don't
you
know
what?
It's a low number. I mean, laptops are easily noticed that they go. Yeah.
But if you even only have one mobile device stolen or lost, that could be really bad if you have the certain information on that laptop. And so NASA is now taking the step of encrypting all of its laptops. And it basically said, okay, enough is enough. We're going to encrypt all of our laptops. We're going to get this done within a month's time. And until this happens, they're actually banning laptops containing sensitive information leaving their facilities. So,
which is a way to do it.
Yeah, it's a very good way to do it. So it'll be interesting to see over time how many organizations do this.
Okay, so then what happens if you forget your passcode? We're going to take a call from Prunedale. Jerry, hello.
Yeah, hey, how's everything?
Doing okay?
Yeah, I've got an old hacked 2G iPhone.
So the original iPhone?
Yeah, the big clunky one, yeah. And the wife, I don't know what she was doing. She locked out her passcode. So the iPhone is dead. I mean, we basically bricked it. And I'm trying to figure out what to do.
Dead as in it just locked down after you tried too many times?
Right, and then you can go in and restore it and try to refresh it and you get a second chance.
Right, but you still don't have the passcode.
Still haven't figured out the passcode yet.
Ooh, I actually don't know the recovery procedure for this.
Neither do I. You know, I think in this case, although I hate to say it, Google might actually be your best friend because, I know I don't have an iPhone. Miles, you do, but it's a more recent one.
The software is the same, and yeah, I had the original one as well. Although, to my eternal shame, I did not have a passcode on that.
Oh, no.
But then again, I didn't really have linking to my financials.
Yeah, who wants to hack Miles anyway?
You're all right. You're still a good person, Mike.
If you go to Google, there will have some tips. Unfortunately, I don't have them off the top of my head right now. I've never had to do that myself. Sorry about that.
It's been a journey already. It's been 3 or 4 days now that we've been trying to.
I'm sorry.
But the other thing is it's an old 2G-er, and it was hacked and jailbroke, so I'm with T-Mobile, and it's really cheap.
Yeah, the only other thing I can think of...
Where should I go next?
Yeah, the only other thing I can think of is you don't restore from a backup, but you would rather restore... you would just do a new install of the OS, and then just resync your data again. Because all your settings will be back to factory defaults, but you'll be able to... have access to the email account.
So effectively wiping the device and then resyncing from the cloud.
Yeah.
Yeah. Goodbye contacts and all the.
Well, hopefully that shuts stuff.
Did you ever synced your phone with the laptop before, right?
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
Okay, so those contacts should be on your computer already.
Okay.
So if you wipe it, you should be able to get those contacts back onto your phone.
I need to sync my phone.
Other thing is now back in 2007, 2008, when I did this thing, they had the version of, I think it was 8.1.2 or something like that, where you could go in and sync it. And what I'm finding now, we're up to 10.2.
Oh, that's of iTunes. Okay.
Yeah, of iTunes, yeah. And it's like, it doesn't seem to like my iPhone either when I sync it up with the... with the newest version of iTunes.
Okay. Oh, well, unfortunately, I don't have any solution other than trying to wipe it with a clean install and trying to do a sync. Your backup will still be there, though, if you want to try that in the future.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time. Sorry, let us know how it goes.
All right, talk to you.
Take care. Bye. And unfortunately, Mardine, I'm sorry we won't be able to get to you. She has a...
Our next caller.
So please just call us back next week. We'd love to talk to you about it if your geek revenge is... your little prank is still on. Geekspeak on KOSP is supported by Rent a Living Christmas Tree, offering 4 to 8 foot tall live potted Christmas trees delivered to the home and picked up after the holidays. Details online at rentchristmastree.com and 831-624-8733. That is 624-TREE. And L'Atelier Salon and Spa, located in downtown Santa Cruz, offering hair, skin, nail, and bodywork services with biodynamic organic products and customized salon and spa experiences. More information and online appointment bookings at LATELIERSalon.com. Celebrating 40 years together, this is 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, streaming and podcasting at KUSP.com.